If my people, who are called by my name, humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land.
Thanks for joining us on Mission 66, an adventure through God's Word, brought to you by TWR and the teaching ministry of Dr. Luis Seau. Today, we'll learn about God's continuing provision and the discipline for the nation of Israel in the book of 2 Kings. Find your free downloadable study guide at mission66.org. John Matthews and Esther Sisulu are waiting, so let's dive in.
Welcome to our program where we read the Bible chapter by chapter and we discuss the parts that need clarifying. Now today we are moving further into the second book of Kings and we're looking at chapters 12 through 15. Now we're going to cover quite a lot of ground, so our teacher John Matthews will take us through with the theme, A Downward Slide.
Thank you, Esther, and a very warm welcome to this latest episode of Mission 66. So good to be with you wherever you join us from today. And today we are going to be scanning through, as Esther mentioned there, four chapters as we come across more of the kings of old Israel and of Judah, which by this stage were two separate kingdoms and a long way removed from the relative peace of the days when David and his son Solomon had ruled. So these divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah, I'm afraid to say, they were both on this downward slide. In chapter 12, though, we learn of a good king. His name was Joash, otherwise known as Jehoash. And he took over the throne of Judah at the age of just 7 years old. Imagine that. And his affairs of state, well, they were managed by adults, initially led by Jehoiada, the priest. And it said that Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, except that he failed to remove all idolatry from the southern kingdom. Well, Joash requested that the people bring silver as a sacred offering for the temple of the Lord, which was then used to pay the workers tasked with maintenance and the repairs of Solomon's temple. So this project is actually the central focus of chapter 12. And when Joash is old enough to really take ownership of his position, he realizes that the priests had been taking money but hadn't done any repairs to the temple. And so he confronts them about this and they then agree to take no more money, but they would get busy doing what they were initially supposed to do, and that is repair the house of God. And so this work begins then in earnest with the carpenters, the stonemasons, and the craftsmen working hard and dealing so honestly that no accounting was necessary. And it seems that the good-hearted labourers were more honest in their dealings regarding money than the priests were. And then moving forward, verse 17 states that Hazael, king of Aram, goes up and attacks the Philistine city of Gath, captures it, then turns his attention to Jerusalem. But Joash, king of Judah, instead of protesting, he bribes Hazael with all the sacred objects, as well as the gifts he himself had dedicated and all the gold found in the treasuries of the temple of the Lord. And so Hazael withdraws from Jerusalem, but great damage had been done to his prestige. And then in Chronicles, we're going to find out that Joash ceased listening to the counsel of righteous men and begins listening to the counsel, to the wisdom of the ungodly, or so-called wisdom. So this otherwise good king who'd influenced the people to serve God was now a different, very different kind of king who leads his subjects astray. His own servants saw what was happening and put a stop to it themselves because they killed Joash in the 40th year of his reign, and Joash's son Amaziah takes the throne in Judah. But what a tragic tale, another tragic tale. And at this point, we begin to notice then the emergence of international powers in the Middle East. Israel and Judah, they were losing territory and they faced these threats from Aram, Assyria, and later Babylon. Then in chapter 13, Jehoaz, the son of Jehu, reigns in Israel from 814 BC to 798 BC, and he does evil in those 17 years, so that God brings Hazael the Syrian against him by way of discipline. And Jehoaz seeks God when he's in trouble, and God has mercy on him, well, some mercy on him, but his army was decimated. And then he dies and his son Joash took over in Israel. This is a different Joash from the one who'd been king in Judah. Adding to the confusion is that they were both known by two names, Joash and Jehoash. Apologies for that. And then in Judah, this particular Joash's 40-year reign is notable, followed by Amaziah, who rules for about 30 years, then Uzziah, who is generally a good king, and finally Jotham, and that is all covered in those chapters. But there's a remarkable event that occurs in chapter 13. Here is verse 14. Listen to this. Now, when Elisha had fallen sick with the illness of which he was to die, Joash, king of Israel, went down to him and wept before him, crying, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And Elisha said to him, take a bow and arrows. So he took a bow and arrows. Then he said to the king of Israel, draw the bow. And he drew it. And Elisha laid his hands on the king's hands, and he said, open the window eastward, and he opened it. And then Elisha said, shoot, and he shot. And he said, the Lord's arrow of victory, the arrow of victory over Syria, for you shall fight the Syrians in Aphek until you have made an end of them. And he said, take the arrows, and he took them, and he said to the king of Israel, strike the ground with them. And he struck three times and stopped. Then the man of God was angry with him and said, you should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck down Syria until you'd made an end of it. But now you will strike down Syria only three times. So despite Jehoash's victories over Aram, his reign was still considered to be a wicked one by God. And then chapter 14 introduces Amaziah, the king of Judah, who reigns for 29 years in Jerusalem. And the text highlights both positive aspects of his reign and some negative. He starts out by doing right, but not wholeheartedly. And when the kingdom was firmly in his grasp, he executes the officials who had murdered his father, the king. As you can see, patterns of behaviour repeated over and over and over again through the history of Israel. Yet he doesn't put the children of the assassins to death, because it says in the law of Moses, parents are not to be put to death for the sin of their children, nor children for the sin of their parents. And Amaziah, well, he achieves notable victories. He defeats the Edomites and captures Selah. However, he gets involved in a war that did not have to be, when he challenges Jehoash of Israel. And chapter 14, verse 8 says, then Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, come, let us look one another in the face. And Jehoash, king of Israel, sent word to Amaziah, king of Judah, a thistle on Lebanon sent to a cedar on Lebanon, saying, give your daughter to my son for a wife. And a wild beast of Lebanon passed by and trampled down the thistle. You have indeed struck down Edom, and your heart has lifted you up. Be content with your glory and stay at home. For why should you provoke trouble so that you fall, you and Judah with you? But Amaziah would not listen. So Jehoash, king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced one another in battle at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah was defeated by Israel, and every man fled to his home. And Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, son of Ahaziah, at Beth Shemesh and came to Jerusalem and broke down the wall of Jerusalem for 400 cubits from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. And he seized all the gold and the silver and all the vessels that were found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, also hostages, and he returned to Samaria. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoash, it says in verse 15 that he did and his might and how he fought with Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So chapter 14 also mentions the rise of Jeroboam the second, who ruled the northern kingdom Israel for 41 years from 793 BC to 753 BC. He expands Israel's borders, but remains spiritually corrupt. The downward slide worsens, on it goes, unabated, really. All this activity, but the downward slide is unabated. It goes right through the history of Israel here, and the Lord sees how bitterly everyone in Israel, whether they were slave or free, is suffering. And since the Lord had said that he would not blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, and the Lord saves them by the hand of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash. And then chapter 15 lists some more kings, several kings. Azariah, also known as Uzziah, reigns in the southern kingdom, Judah, for 50 years, beginning at the age of 16. He was a good and well-beloved king. His reign was marked by relative peace, though he was struck himself with leprosy due to an incident in which he usurped the office of the priests. You can see that incident in Chronicles. And then the northern kingdom, Israel's succession of kings become increasingly chaotic, if they weren't already chaotic, with reigns marked by assassinations, instability, much more of what we've read a lot of already. Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam II, he reigned just 6 months. He was murdered by one called Shallum, who took his place even though he was not heir to the throne. His rule ended up being even shorter, 1 month. Then Shallum was murdered by a guy called Menahem, cruel man, whose reign lasted 10 years, during which he was forced to pay 35 tons of gold to Assyria as protection money. The Syria saying, pay me money or we'll come and wipe you off the face of the earth. Menahem didn't seem to care. It wasn't his money. So he just extracted the amount from the wealthiest people in Israel by way of taxes. Then Menahem's son, Pekahiah, rules for 2 years before he murders a guy named Pekah. So as the father does, so does the son, both of them continuing in the same chronic sins that had been the downfall of their forefathers. And so you see this generation to generation to generation, not much is changing. It's violence, it's murder. And in fact, the longer the northern kingdom stuck to its idolatry and Baal worship, the more violent, in fact, it seems, become the deaths of their kings. And the last, let's be honest, Esther, this is not the most uplifting read, is it? It's a pretty much a litany of violence and murder, unfortunately. It's not an easy read. And the last several kings of the northern kingdom mentioned here, guess what? They die by assassination. And then chapter 15 ends with Jotham, the son of Uzziah, ruling the southern kingdom, Judah, for 25 years. And this is what is written of him in verse 34. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that his father Uzziah had done. Nevertheless, the high places were not removed. How many times have we read that verse in this, in 1 and 2 Kings, and the people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places? So, Esther, in the overview of those four chapters of 2 Kings, both Israel and Judah had fallen or continued to fall in a period of serious downward decline. The kings forget God's covenant. They lead their kingdoms to ruin. The northern kingdom was going to be invaded very soon by the Assyrian armies. That happens in 722 BC, and the southern kingdom was to face a similar fate from the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, and that was 586 BC. Goodness me.
Well, dear friends, I'm Esther, your host, here on Mission 66 with our teacher, John Matthews. And of course, we are looking into 2 Kings, looking at chapters 12 through to 15. And John, this is incredible because it really seems that Israel, as they got further and further away from worshiping God, they really fell deeper and deeper into trouble, didn't they? And I think that this really paints a picture of the endless depths of sin and its consequences. So just considering all of that, is there a message for us in our 21st century? What can we learn from the Israelites?
Yeah, it's a good question. And actually, as I'm reading through that, Esther, I'm thinking, cool, there are similar parallels to our world today. There really are. Echoes of 2 Kings are very clearly apparent in many nations on our planet right now. Modern idols, that line about maybe a king does well, but they did not remove the high places, the altars, the idols. And modern idols, all the things that take the place of God, well, they're a little different to the Baal worshippers, but they're things like wealth, fame, technology, power, nationalism. And so you have, or we have, this moral relativism, idolatry, this crisis of leadership, people trying to rule by their own flawed wisdom rather than God's. There's a disregard, isn't there, in our world today for truth. So then, with a disregard for truth, or calls for humility, repentance, and integrity, well, they're downgraded or even ignored in favour of rhetoric that enables people to behave in whatever way they want. And that echoes very closely with what we've just seen in those chapters. And so today we may hear it described this way. Well, it's my truth. It's my truth. Meanwhile, there's this increasing social division and the vulnerable are more easily forgotten or exploited. And so there's a spiritual apathy and coldness. You know, when the truth is downgraded, we're in really dangerous territory. But God never gives up, Esther. And even here in the midst of what is, let's be honest, a tough read, he is and has set the stage for redemption, not through the monarchy of Israel and Judah. No, no, no. That was flawed, fallen, and destined to come to a disastrous end. No doubt about that. Not through that. But through Jesus, the only true king. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, in the midst of this kind of situation that we've just read about here, what does God say? This is what God says in the midst of this. He says, look, if my people who are called by my name humble themselves, there's that key word, humble. That's a way I think we struggle today. We don't know how to humble ourselves. But he says, if my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then here's a promise. In fact, there's 3 promises. I will hear from heaven. I will forgive their sin. And I will heal their land. You know, we can carry the candle of life contained in the Bible and in his Holy Spirit that lives within us. And as we do, maybe some will see the light and come towards it.
All right, John. Well, you know, when considering the text, and especially when it came, in fact, to the end of a king's reign, it says the rest of his acts are written in a book called the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. All right, so do we still have access to that book? Is it available to us? Where is it?
Yeah, no, we don't. Not as far as we know, anyway. We don't have that Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. That's a more detailed account of the Northern Kingdom Israel, probably compiled, actually, by the scribes who lived at the time. It may have been the source from which parts of the Bible account were drawn, but 1st and 2nd Chronicles, which are in the Bible, and they come after Kings, they deal only with the kings of Judah.
Okay. So look, these chapters are very historical, right? Very heavy in history. So what do you think would be the most important historical segments in these particular parts that we're reading?
Yeah, that's a really hard one to answer, actually. And I'm not sure. I guess some people would say certain bits are more relevant than others, or, yeah, more indicative or more significant of what follows. But I think one of the most significant developments here, and it's interesting to see, is the rise and the expansion of Assyria, which is clearly becoming a great superpower in the 8th century BC. And here we pick up some names that do deserve our attention, actually, but particularly Tiglath-Pileser, also known as Pul. Now, that's a peculiar name, but during this period, this guy begins military campaigns which forebode attacks against Israel itself. And in many ways, Esther, you know, what are we talking? The 8th century BC are setting a precedent that we see right up hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later. We see those same tensions ongoing today, right? But this is where it begins, back in the 8th century BC. And let's take it back to that time, because further troubles are going to arise with kings like Esarhaddon, Sargon II, and Sennacherib. And so Assyria is going to become this great tormentor. And so what you've got is this international stage shifting dramatically, actually. Israel and Judah, well, they are in decline and are ultimately going to end up with them being taken into exile.
Well, it definitely feels familiar to what we experience in the days that we live in. But, you know, something that I picked up as we were reading through these chapters, and I'm pretty sure you have as well, John, is that this name, Jeroboam, keeps coming up over and over again. So why is Jeroboam mentioned so often in the Bible?
Yeah, it does keep popping up, doesn't it? It's because Jeroboam the First, the son of Nebat, he was the originator of the northern kingdom. You might remember he fled from Solomon and took the throne of the northern kingdom during its rupture from Solomon's son Rehoboam. He was the one who initiated golden calf worship. And all the kings after him were into that as well, to one degree or another. And so Jeroboam the First becomes, he becomes a symbol of evil, actually. If the king behaved in an evil way, he was said to have followed in the footsteps of Jeroboam. It was like a saying. He's following in the footsteps of Jeroboam. And then there was another Jeroboam, Jeroboam the Second, who reigned in Israel for 41 years, from 793 to 753 BC, and I'm afraid he wasn't much better than his namesake in terms of the way he ruled.
That's honestly quite unfortunate to hear. I'm looking forward to the times where we get to the kings who did right in the sight of the Lord, but I suppose we'll get to those. You alluded to them, but let's shift to Elisha for a moment, because you've mentioned several times, and in fact we've seen it in the chapters, that, you know, he performed these great miracles, but we do see in chapter 13, verse 14, that he died of illness, like many of the other prophets do, or many people do. And I suppose, you know, as we read into the story, you think to yourself, well, look, if I had that kind of power, I would most certainly pray over myself and hopefully be healed. So my question is, why was this not the case for Elisha? Why did he not heal himself?
Yeah, well, one point to make on the kings is that pretty much those who wanted to follow the way of the Lord were pretty much done and dusted. There were one or two, we mentioned Joash, but the die is almost cast for both Israel and Judah by this stage. But in answer to that question, Esther, you know, death is a result of the curse that Adam and Eve entered or got us involved in. You know, they were meant to live forever in perfection in that garden or in that world that God had created. But sin enters the picture, the scene at that time. And ever since, everybody comes to the end of their life on earth, because as sin enters the picture, so does death. But the good news is that those who believe God have the certain hope of resurrection with a completely new body that will never wear out. And when you think about it, death is an incredible blessing for believers in Jesus, because we get to experience through that permanent healing and eternal life. But far greater than even that is the fact that we see Jesus and we spend forevermore with the one, the only one, who makes us whole and complete, who loves us. And that's another thing here. God sent, didn't he, the cherub to guard that tree of life once sin had entered the world, lest anyone should accidentally eat that fruit and then end up living forever in a fallen, sin-cursed body.
What a disaster that would have been. Thank God for that. You know, I'm just thinking how, although Elisha was powerful, he was a servant of God, his illness really does remind us that no matter how spiritual someone is, they are still human. And I think this is important to note, John, because lots of people get lured into Christianity under the pretenses of health, wealth, and prosperity. But of course, there is a truth in the Bible that we share here on Mission 66.
Yeah, and this life is fleeting. You know, this life is like a drop in the ocean, and it's an important drop because it prepares us for what comes next, and what comes next is eternal. And so, yeah, you know, in response to the question, having the gift of healing doesn't make someone divine. Healings are at best temporary. You know, even those whom Jesus raised from the dead, well, they died sometime later, you know, so healing is a gift for now, but it is a temporary gift.
Well, I really enjoyed that discussion, John. Thank you so much for your insights. And let's get right into the summary for today's episode.
Yeah, well, today we were in the second book of Kings, looking at chapters 12 through 15. And our theme was a downward slide. It meant or means the spiritual and political decline of Israel and Judah during the divided kingdom era. Judah briefly experienced a little hope under King Joash. He becomes king aged 7 with a little guidance from Jehoiada the priest. But he repairs Solomon's temple, initially follows God's ways, but fails to remove all the idolatry, and later he abandons godly counsel altogether, leading the kingdom astray. His reign then ends in betrayal, assassination. He's succeeded by Amaziah, Uzziah, Jotham. These kings, again, they had occasional moments of virtue, but they allow idolatry to persist. So their foundations are flawed, and that all contributes to Judah's eventual downfall in Israel. Meanwhile, the idolatry of Jeroboam the First sets this precedent for sin that plagues all subsequent kings. Jehoaz, Jehoash, they seek God's mercy during crises, but they continue the wicked or the evil practices. Jeroboam the Second expands Israel's territory, but perpetuates the spiritual corruption. And Israel's leadership grows increasingly unstable, marked by assassinations, brief reigns, such as Zechariah's 6-month rule and Shalom's 1-month rule. And the northern kingdom is facing these external threats, particularly from the rising Assyrian Empire. Chapter 13 highlights the death then of Elisha, who performed great miracles, but he too succumbs to illness, illustrating that human mortality is very real, despite whatever spiritual gifts may be gifted for the period of a lifetime. His final act symbolizes victories for Israel over Aram, but those victories were to be limited. And the overarching lesson or theme, I think, is that nations and individuals blessed with spiritual truth are held all the more accountable for their actions. Israel and Judah's rejection of God's covenant leads to a downward slide and exile. The exile would come for Israel through the Assyrians invading in 722 BC, and for Judah it was going to be 586 BC by Babylon. And the decline reminds us that obedience to God, well, it brings blessing, but rejecting his light results in consequences and judgment. But still, the hope of restoration remains for those who trust and hold to God's promises.
Well, that was a fascinating fascinating dive into the history of Israel and Judah. And of course, next time we look forward to moving further into 2 Kings with you. Friend, we also, of course, would love to hear your thoughts on this episode or any episode that may have sparked your interest. So please leave your comment or your question on our Facebook page at Mission 66. Like it, comment on our statuses, and let's keep this conversation going. So I'm Esther for John and our entire team saying, see you next time on Mission 66.
As Mission 66 comes to a close, be sure to download your free study guide at mission66.org. Deepen your daily devotion with insights from each episode, and let John and Esther lead you through the scriptures. Get your study guide at mission66.org. And be prepared for our next episode. There, you can also connect with us, ask questions, or donate to help Mission 66's worldwide outreach. Head to mission66.org. Mission 66 is made possible through Transworld Radio in partnership with Dr. Luis Seau.